Welcome to So-Called Normal. I'm Mark Hennick. It's been 1 year since I first received the galleys, the physical version of my new book that just came out earlier this year, So-Called Normal, a memoir of family depression and resilience. I've shared a short excerpt on this podcast before, so I thought I would share another now just to mark this pretty monumental occasion for me of holding this story in my hands that I've been working for so long on. So I'm sharing with you here now chapter 5 from my book, So-Called Normal. This is copyright by me, Mark Hennick, and published by HarperCollins Publishers Limited. You can get the book wherever books are sold here in Canada, where I'm based at Indigo or at Amazon Canada, most other bookstores in the US at Barnes & Noble, Target, Amazon there as well, Amazon worldwide, in fact. So please look up the book if you like what you hear here and share it with your friends and family. So here's a reading from Chapter 5 of So-Called Normal, a memoir of family, depression, and resilience. With Raymond and Krista both gone, it was just me, my mom, and Gary, as well as whichever of his rotating cast of kids happened to be back. Mom tried to leave next. My mother and Gary had been together for about 5 years by then. Mom never had much confidence that she could make it on her own, that she could live without a man in her life to support her and control her. I don't think she realized that she had already raised 3 kids essentially as a single parent. It was hard, but hard was okay. And she did it through grit and determination. She woke up each morning before dawn and pulled herself out of bed in order to support her kids. There was no other option. She just put her head down and got it done. She had all but begged Gary to set a wedding date ever since he proposed, but it was becoming clear as the years went by that he had no intention of marrying her. It was in part the promise of marriage that made her stay, the hope that someday things would be better. However, after her first grandchild was born, I think she started to feel more confident, and that she didn't have to wait for somebody else to make her life meaningful. Maybe my mother started to realize that she was going to leave a legacy regardless. With her kids growing up, moving out, having kids of their own, maybe she realized she could be an independent woman after all. That's when she really started trying to leave. One August day, just after noon, Mom and I rushed down the concrete walkway to the car in the driveway. We were making our escape from the house at the end of the dead-end dirt road, from the fields and forest, from the silence and the screaming. Gary and my mom had been fighting all morning. It was the first of many times that she would try to leave. "Get back in the house, you crazy bitch," Gary shouted from the side step. Whereas my mom cried when she screamed, Gary smiled. "No, fuck you. Fuck you, you fucking bastard," Mom screamed back. Her voice was raw, her face red, her cheeks, lips, brow trembling, her eyes filled with tears. She put her bag in the back seat. I stood at the passenger side door, watching as usual, my own bag already in the car. "I will never step foot in this fucking house again," she swore. I'm not sure that any of us believed her. "What time is it, Brenda?" Gary asked. She didn't answer, just glared. 20 minutes, he pronounced. "Give me 20 minutes, and I'll have someone else in here to replace you," he said. Gary repeatedly worked that weak spot, her lack of faith in herself, her replaceability. Mom seethed, hurt. "Good," she finally screamed back. She ordered me into the car, got behind the wheel, and slammed the door. She started the car, jammed it hard into reverse, and sped backward up the long driveway between the big concrete light posts. Shifting into drive, she looked up. Gary was standing on the walkway, at the bottom of the steps. As she reached her arm past me, I felt the heat emanating from her skin. She got her hand as close to the window on my side as possible. Then she gave Gary the middle finger and drove off. Gary never did get another woman on this escape or any of the others that came after. Whenever we left, Gary himself never seemed to change. But something in his house would alter instead. There'd be a different one of his kids visiting, or he'd be working on some new landscaping project on his property, or he'd be remodeling some room in the house, usually in the basement. Fix the foundation. Maybe that'll change things. He always talked about raising the house up a few feet to get a bit more headroom down there, but he never did. As I got taller, I could easily touch the ceiling when I stood in the basement. I had at least 4 different bedrooms in that little basement, as Gary kept moving the walls, readjusting the boundaries each time we left and returned, left and returned. We stayed at Nana Ag's house. She had one of her many little biblical passage decorations on the bedroom wall. It was from the parable of the wise and foolish builders. The rain fell, the floods came, and the winds blew and buffeted the house, it read. But it did not collapse. It had been set solidly on rock. The little framed picture didn't mention the part about the fool who built his house on sand. We went back to Gary's after a few days. When I changed schools to start 7th grade from South Barr to Whitney Pier Memorial Junior High School, I also entered the French immersion program. I had liked learning French in grade 6. There was something attractive to me about having a language all to myself at home, where nobody else could understand it. I did well in my hour-long lessons, so I expected it to be much the same when I switched almost exclusively to French. I was wrong. It was too much change all at once. It was like a whole different world from the one I knew. I didn't know any of the teachers, and the school was much bigger than my last one. South Barr had one central hallway, while Memorial had 4 floors, with a loop of hallway around each, and classrooms on both sides. I didn't know anybody outside of the school who spoke French, other than my Aunt Pat on Mom's side. But I had way too many aunts and uncles to be close to all of them. I didn't understand any of the work. It felt as if I'd been parachuted into a foreign country where I couldn't navigate or communicate, where I had nowhere to turn. But it wasn't all bleak. My homeroom teacher was young and pretty. She seemed to like me. I sure liked her. I liked how nice she was to me. I liked how she seemed to actually listen. How she looked me straight in the eyes when she spoke to me. I liked how her blouse clung to her body, illuminated by the sun through the window as she wrote on the blackboard. Apparently, in addition to my new school, in a new language, I was also entering into a new kind of awareness of the people around me. I was especially starting to notice more of the girls and women in my proximity. Things seemed to slowly adjust at school as I started to build some routines. But the situation at home was still hard. With my brother and sister gone and the occasional flight into exile with my mother, it was hard to find any balance. At home, I felt isolated, guilty, shameful, unwelcome yet trapped, and increasingly unsafe. These feelings, never having been resolved as they developed over the years, they just continued to grow wider and deeper inside me. I didn't dare invite friends over to the house because I had no idea what Gary might say or do to them. I couldn't risk the social cost. What if people went back to school and spread word that my dad, as he was inevitably called before I issued a quick correction, had made them pick rocks from the field or chop wood or fight each other in some weird competition of manliness? I was insecure, as though my feet were always on sand, and I had to be ready for any possible attack. Not all of my worries were entirely irrational. I just couldn't tell which ones were. At the beginning, I felt safer at my new school than I did at home. As it happened when I went to South Barr, I slowly started to move from fear of the unknown to seeing the school as a refuge, a safe space. Over the first few weeks, I grew close to a couple of teachers, especially Mrs. Marmaluk and Mrs. Walsh. I felt they took the time and the effort to look at me tenderly, without judgment or contempt. I believe they saw some of the real me that I was learning to hide inside. They both mentioned having kids with special needs at one point, so maybe that had something to do with their particular capacity for kindness. However, the process was interrupted when I started to attract some new bullies. I was at my locker one day when one of them cornered me. He'd been threatening me for a few weeks, but he never made time to stop and introduce himself, so I didn't know his name at the time. I later learned it was Alan. Alan and some of his gang had taken to waiting for me outside the school, so I often stayed inside long after the last bell to avoid encountering them. I didn't expect him ever to confront me inside. I was tall, but he was taller. He was also heavier, faster, and stronger than me. He found me in the half-level basement, the pit, we called it, where the main bank of lockers was located. He rushed at me like a charging bull, and we collided straight on. I hit the line of tall metal locker doors behind me hard. A crowd descended immediately, hearing the crash echoing through the pit. "Fight, fight, fight, fight," the other students chanted in rabid unison. I bounced back toward him or propelled myself out at him out of blind instinct, I'm not sure. I saw my arm shoot out in front of me. I wasn't thinking for a change. And in a rush of adrenaline, I grabbed him by the throat. He grabbed me with both hands by the front of my shirt. I thought of the way Gary had held Raymond and pinned him against the wall, of the way my brother had writhed and flailed. I squeezed my fingers closed as hard as I could. I felt my nails sink deep into the soft tissue on either side of his Adam's apple, and as I did, I locked him in direct eye contact. Eye contact normally made me extremely uncomfortable, as though people could see my secrets behind my eyes. But not this time. His brown eyes bulged big and round. His lips sputtered and gasped, revealing his clenched teeth. But he wouldn't let go. So neither did I. We held each other close, locked for what felt like an eternity, but was probably only a few seconds. He was growling or choking. And his olive skin started to blush a deep red. I kicked him once hard in the stomach. He should have protected himself, Gary would have said, if he had been watching. Alan suddenly jerked away sharply. He let go of my shirt and shoved me back. I rushed forward, intending to kick him again, but I missed. I saw the vice principal pushing toward us through the crowd. He was tall, with a white beard and owl-like eyes, and he was shouting for us to stop. Just before he got to us, though, Alan wound up and sent one speeding bulldozer punch directly toward my head. Laser-focused and in full self-defense mode, I weaved only a degree or two to the right. His fist whizzed past my left ear and crashed into the locker behind me, denting the aluminum door and sending another loud echo reverberating over the noise. The crowd roared louder. My ears were ringing. The vice principal arrived a moment later and broke us up. He asked if I was okay. I don't remember what I said. As the vice principal escorted Alan by the arm through the parting crowd out of the pit, Alan jerked away from him and punched one more locker on the way, sending one last crash echoing through the space. I finally jumped, startled. The crowd thinned and dissipated quickly, and everything became silent. All I could hear was my heart pounding in my ears. I must have collected myself and got the bus home, as I always did, but there's a gap in my memory. When my awareness came back, I had gotten off the bus and was walking down Gary's long driveway. I continued past the house to the very end of the gravel in the clearing around the bend. I went down the grassy path into the woods, to the wall of trees. I didn't stop this time. I didn't retreat back to the house. I pushed through the leafy barrier without hesitation. The ground was rough, but I went slowly, careful to navigate around the fallen branches and little hills, over the boggy valleys and slippery moss. It was hard at first, but it became easier once I got used to the terrain. I didn't know where I was going. I just went. My instinct was to run, to hide, to disappear forever. As I went deeper into the woods, I heard a trickle of water. I came to a little embankment and climbed to the top. On the other side was a shimmering brook, a tiny flowing stream, no more than ankle-deep in some places, knee-deep in others. It wound a thin thread through the trees, escaping from sight in both directions. I sat down on the embankment. I could finally breathe again. Under a dappled canopy of leaves, I watched the water. This water had somewhere it was supposed to go, I thought. It didn't have some supernatural consciousness. It didn't have to think at all. It just collected itself and carved an ever more certain rut in the earth as it went, getting faster when it rained and deeper over time. It could no more escape its destiny than I could. I studied the stones that sat beneath the crystal water. If they'd ever been jagged, broken free from a larger form in the eroding embankment, here they were now, underwater, in the middle of the woods, smooth and round. They had been worn and shaped by the current, all the loose sand around them carried away, and yet still they were rock. I noticed the sun. I felt the warmth shine through the leaves above me, on my shoulders, and then, when I looked up, the sun on my face. I closed my eyes. I carved each small detail into every sense memory, so that I could take it with me wherever I went. All I had to do was close my eyes again, and I could feel the sun and the earth, smell the pine and moss, hear the trickling water and see the stones. I'd rather be there than anywhere else, even if only in my mind. I could escape here, to this special place in my head, and be safe. This place understood me, in a way that I didn't yet know I needed to be understood. When I opened my eyes, the sun had gone behind a cloud, and the woods were darker. I noticed the cool breeze from which the warm sun had distracted me. I watched a leaf blow free from a treetop above. It floated down toward me. It landed on the water and was swept away. The leaf was orange. I looked around and noticed that a lot of them were. I felt a sudden sense of hopeless dread. I didn't know how I hadn't seen it before. Summer was over. Thanks for listening to this excerpt from So-Called Normal, a memoir of family, depression, and resilience. Copyright 2021 by Mark Hennick, published by HarperCollins Publishers Limited. You can get a copy of this book on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, Indigo, Waterstones in the UK, I think, lots of other places. Just Google So-Called Normal and you'll be able to get a copy of the book. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Mark Hennick. Take care.